The March 19th primary is less than a week away, but for many voters, picking candidates in the judges' races is something they'll simply skip over because they don't know anything about the candidates. But judges have huge power over certain aspects of the legal system, and voters should be involved in deciding who wields that power. Now Signal Cleveland and the Marshall Project have created a voting guide on the judicial races in Cuyahoga County, complete with descriptions of the candidates. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll talk to Rachel DeSalle, the editor of the voting guide for Cuyahoga County judicial races, about what the judges do and how to navigate the guide. Later in the show, a conversation with producer Drew Mazias and the author of a book chronicling the music venue and coffee shop, Le Cove. They featured the likes of Neil Young, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and Jeff Beck. Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's the Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Becoming informed about what judges to vote for takes time and research. And a majority of Ohioans have admitted to leaving that section blank on the ballot, according to the Ohio Judicial Election Survey. The Marshall Project also found that in the 2020 general election, about one-third of people in Cuyahoga County skipped voting for judges who hear felony cases, and the reason given was simply a lack of information. Recently, the Marshall Project and Signal Cleveland collaborated on a voter guide that's user-friendly and accessible about not only the candidates on this year's primary ballots, but also answers common questions about the court system, like how does someone become a judge, and what do the different courts do? Today, we're going to explore these questions with the guide, with Rachel DeSalle, Community and Special Projects Editor for both of these nonprofit newsrooms. Rachel, so glad to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me on today. I'm excited to talk about this.
So are we. If you want to follow along and have questions about this guide, you can, first of all, the guide is on today's show page at ideastream.org/SOI. And then with your questions or thoughts about judicial elections, you can call us toll-free 866-578-0903. Once again, 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So, Rachel, in the Marshall Project's previous reporting on who votes for judges and who doesn't, it highlighted the fact that the voters most likely to pick judges live in the suburbs that are predominantly white and wealthy, and that far fewer voters come from Cleveland proper, even though people who often face criminal charges mainly come from the city and most are Black. Can you explain some more of those reasons why people don't vote for judges?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really interesting because what we wanted to explore was this power dynamic, because judges hold a lot of power in people's lives. And really, whether someone is charged with a crime or whether their family member is charged with a crime or if they're a victim, right? You know, there's this system that they're ending up being a part of. And we really learned that they weren't taking part in picking the people who make all the decisions in that system. And so after doing that reporting and really kind of drilling into that dynamic, we started to talk to more and more people about it. And we actually worked with our Cleveland Documenters community. They fanned out and interviewed people across the city, and they learned a couple of things. And some of them were surprising to me. You know, I had made an assumption that, you know, some folks thought that the justice system was harmful, and so they didn't really want to take part in an election about that. And for some people, that was true. But for a lot of people, they were really saying that, I can't find the information that I need and that I want about these folks so I can feel comfortable voting for them. So even folks who are going in to vote in a presidential race or in a city council race were not voting for judges. Mm-hmm. Because they simply didn't know the difference between one Russo and another, or which judges were maybe more harsher with sentencing, you know, which judges agreed with using cash bail and which didn't. So really, it was the things that they wanted to know. You know, we had some people tell us that it doesn't really matter to me where someone went to law school. And that's what I'm seeing in some of these other places. We had one person tell us that, you know, there are these campaign websites, but who has time to look up 14 or 15 different campaign websites and go through them? And so people really wanted a couple things. They wanted the type of information they wanted, and they wanted it kind of gathered up in one place where they could easily access it. And a lot of people told us, I want to be able to pull out my phone when I'm going to go to the voting booth and really look through this. So that was kind of our goal to create this. And one thing that I want to make clear is, like, we talk about this in terms of voting, right? This will help people vote.
Sure.
But really, we view this as a judge guide, a guide to judges. It will have usefulness for people even when it's not election season.
Sure.
We envision people maybe going to court for something and they want to know a little bit about the judge who's going to be on their case. They can pull this up. They can read about them, find out what their history is, you know, see their answers to some questions. So it's really kind of a broader effort to educate people about the judiciary, because a lot of people don't know, you know, things about the court. They don't know, for instance, that, you know, judges have to disclose some of their finances. You know, there's all these things that we wanted to put in one place for people. And so this is kind of just a start. And we're eager to hear how it's useful to people.
And I'm curious, I mean, you kind of already enumerated, but, you know, what ultimately is the harm when a majority of voters don't cast a vote on these judicial races? Then the power of who selects them is what? Left to a very few? I mean, I wonder what percentage of votes actually, you know, account for what person is ultimately a judge in that particular system. I mean, is there any way that you've quantified that? Or is it just pretty, you know, obvious that if a majority of people are saying, I'm leaving it blank, then that's a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's a problem. Of course, everybody gets a choice of what they want to cast a vote for. But if you take, like, the last presidential year, like, this is a presidential election year, only a quarter of the votes in judge races came from the city of Cleveland. And I just don't think we thought about it like that before.
Sure.
You know, and I think in any of our lives, if someone is going to be able to make a decision that affects our lives, we want to be able to have some input into that, right? Mm-hmm. No matter what it is, if it's how we pay taxes or, you know, where our kids go to school, we want to be able to have a part of that decision making. And I don't think people were thinking about it like that. You know,
sure.
People would complain about a judge, and we'd also hear a lot of people say, oh, this is the toughest judge, or, you know, this judge never gives anybody bail, but they didn't really know the answers to those questions. So I think that's the part where we still have work to do.
Sure.
Some of the questions that people have asked us the most are about how judges actually make decisions. And that's not easy information to come by. And part of the reason is because this isn't transparent. You know, the
right.
judiciary is not transparent. You can't go to the court's website and see how often, you know, a judge sentences someone for a specific crime to prison and how often they give them probation.
Right.
But this is basic information that you would think people would want to know. So I think it's part of a broader effort to really kind of push back on the court system to make it be a little bit more transparent to people from the moment someone decides to run for office through when they are already on the bench. Because the other thing that we know is once someone is elected, they are often on the bench for a very long time,
right?
You know, and working on this judge guide.
Because then they do somewhat get incumbent status, right?
They do. And so once someone knows their name, then the people that do vote kind of vote for them. And we saw people, you know, who are on the bench for 20 or 30 years. And sometimes nobody's even running against them.
Interesting.
And so I think that kind of system plays into itself. And the more people that are educated, the more people that have the ability to kind of dig into this, they can make those decisions more, saying, you know, this person did get voted in, but I don't really appreciate the way that they're doing their job. You know, maybe someone else will run against them. It's also a predominantly white judiciary, you know, at the common pleas level. So that's another thing that, you know, people might want to look at and say, well, why is that? Is this representative of the community? Is this representative of folks who, you know, are
right.
having decisions made in their lives?
Sure.
So I think there's a lot of things about that are worth questioning. But the other thing is just that people want to have this information. I think there's this idea that people don't want it. And we've been all over town talking to people about it. And And folks are excited that they can go on their phone and pull up and see not only who's running against each other, but see personal things about them. And so the one thing that's kind of different about this guide is we actually, again, worked with our documenters community because they were very excited about this. And regular residents went and helped research all these candidates
great.
And judges. And they pulled out what we're calling insights about them. And, you know, they kind of looked at their history and their record. And some of the things are personal and some of the things are more about their record. Some of them are news stories. And put those all in, you know, to this tool. So it's something that people can really connect with. It's not just kind of a list of things that they've done in their lives.
Okay, so let's talk about the voter guide, focused mainly on Cuyahoga County's court system. And it starts with an explainer of the court system and what each court does. So why don't we talk about a couple of the different courts and some of the races and how kind of the guide illustrates, you know, who you're voting for and what that judge may potentially do.
Sure. So right now, the information in the guide is focused on the Common Pleas Courts races. And so they have a general division. The general division hears felony cases for adults and for, you know, juveniles that are bound over from juvenile court. And they also hear civil cases, disputes, like lawsuits that are worth more than $15,000. And so that's quite a few cases, you know,
sure.
tens of thousands of cases a year that these judges hear. And so we focused on those judge races for now and the juvenile court judge race. There's one that's contested. And so this is a primary.
Right.
And in Ohio, these primaries are partisan at the county level.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to kind of focus in on those races. There are also a lot of races where nobody's actually running against someone. We've listed those for people so they know. But I was trying to figure out how to explain it to someone. And I told them that it's kind of like a walk-on, you know, in baseball, if anyone's a baseball fan, you basically get on base without having, you know, to do very much. So we did list those out so people can learn about those judges as well. But we focused on the ones where people were running against each other. And in the Common Pleas Court, there's several primaries. And in one of the juvenile races, there's also a primary. So that's the information that is up on the judge's guide now. And then once the primary is over, we will tee up for folks who is running against each other in the general election, which is in November. Those will be the those races are technically nonpartisan, but they will be the winners of, you know, the different primaries. It's technically a Democratic and Republican primary, but there are not any contested races in the Republican primary. So when people go to the tool, they will see the races where there are actually people running against each other first. So they can look at those different candidates all at once and kind of compare them side by side.
And kind of list what they'll be able to see about a candidate.
Absolutely. So at the very outset, they will see these kind of insights, which are basically things that we have pulled out from, you know, their history, from what they said to us. And so that's another really interesting thing. What we did was rather than us coming up with a survey to send out to candidates, you know, where do you live? You know, where'd you go to high school? You know, everybody wants to know where you went to high school around here.
Right.
We actually worked with the community and we did all this outreach with different groups, people who were formerly incarcerated, people who had families who were victims of crime, regular residents. And we came up with a set of questions based on what they wanted to know. And I thought that that was really interesting. People wanted to know how a judge would use their discretion. Because we know judicial discretion is a big deal. You know, you have a lot of leeway in making some of these decisions.
Sure.
They also wanted to know how judges would manage their own biases, right? People were really interested in hearing from candidates directly on how would you recognize and manage your own bias, particularly if you are running for judge and you are a white judge and most of the people in front of you may not look like you. So we asked questions like that, and then we put the candidates' answers right there for people to see. And then there's the other information, you know, their political party, whether they've already been a judge, how long they've been practicing law. We also included something called their financial disclosures. So a lot of people may not know this. There's campaign finance, like who you get
sure.
donations from. But if you're running for judge, you also have to disclose your investments and where you who you get gifts from and things like that. Those are technically public, but they aren't available publicly anywhere. You can't go search them. So we went and requested all of those and attached those to each of these profiles so people can kind of look and get a sense, like, you know, where does this person invest their money?
Interesting.
Do they own property? You know, things right. like that. Just because, you know, that is part of the transparency mission here is giving folks access to this information. But then also distilling it. So if you are in the voting booth and you just kind of need to quick check and remind yourself, and I'll just give like a quick, for instance,
yeah,
you know, Nancy Margaret Russo is in a contested race. She's been a Cuyahoga County Common Pleas judge for a long time. If you go to her profile, you'll see, you know, things about what she's done, right? She started a reentry court in 2007 to work with people who are returning home from prison, but also she was 8 years old when she decided she wanted to be a judge. So
wow.
there's a real mix of this kind of personal and professional there. And I think that people will really like that and connect that. And there's also information from her about her initial concerns about using more personal bonds for people who were coming into court. But now she's more comfortable with it and is using more personal bonds instead of cash bonds.
We got an email from a listener, Michael, who wrote, "It's easy. Just look for someone named Russo." But seriously, what about judge for yourself? It tells you how several reputable sources rate candidates.
Yeah, absolutely. So the name game thing is something we've discussed a lot. And honestly, the biggest ask we got from residents is to create something that decodes who all the different people with the same name are. So that that may be in the works for the next iteration. But that's an important point. So there are a couple of other tools out there. And in my world, you know, when we're trying to encourage people to participate,
sure.
the more tools, the better,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I encourage everybody to use whatever is helpful to them. What we heard when we were doing listening is that people were kind of aware of Judge for Themselves, but the feeling was that this was lawyers telling people who they thought would be a good
right.
judge. And the question that we got was like, well, what about the non-lawyers? What about the regular people?
Sure.
And so I think that lawyers, and I have a lot of lawyers that I know and
of
I've worked
course.
With for years, I really do appreciate their insights. I do think that they know what they like about judges, who they practice in front of, and that is valuable information. But I think when people were going into a voting booth, just seeing a number or just seeing a recommended or not recommended, it's a piece of information. And so what we felt was we were hearing from people is they wanted something that was built a little more for a regular person to say, what do I want to know?
Sure.
You know, and if people want to know which judge candidates lawyers recommend, I think they should definitely look at that tool as well.
All right, Rachel, we have less than 2 minutes left. But, you know, as someone is thinking about going into or going to the polls, maybe on the 19th, maybe prior to, how can they use the guide? And what are there a couple of hotly contested races you think that they should check out before they get into line to vote?
Sure. So the nice thing is if you go to the judge guide, which I know is linked to on your website,
yep.
the first thing that you'll see is a tab that'll scroll up that'll say March primary election. And you literally on your phone, which is how we know most people will use this, you can just scroll up and it will be automatically paired for you, these races. So there's some contested races in the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas, and that's Nancy Margaret Russo and Carl Mazzone. There's a three-way race, two three-way primaries, actually, which I think that can be the most complicated for people. You'll see the information on all of those folks right there. There's also one juvenile court race. I do think that that is one that's really interesting to watch. There's a long standing judge, Allison Nelson Floyd, who is has someone running against her, Joseph P. O'Malley. It's interesting. Allison Floyd is the only remaining black judge on the juvenile court. If for some reason Joseph P. O'Malley, who is actually the brother of the court's current administrative judge, were to prevail in that primary, the juvenile court would be an all-white court of judges, and three of them would be O'Malley's.
Mm.
Now, I am not saying, you know, that is a good or bad thing, but I'm just saying these are things that people need to know.
Okay. A couple of emails before I have to let you go, unfortunately. But Mark wrote in saying, so much talk about researching in the booth as a voter and poll worker. Please do your homework and be prepared so lines back up. Don't back up. So, you know, that's probably good advice, is to take a look at this voter guide even before you leave your house and peruse it. Look it over so that when you know who you're going to vote for when you get to the voting booth. And then Dave from Cleveland Heights wrote, this is just one more piece of evidence that Rachel DeCell is a good candidate for best investigative journalist ever. You've got my vote. Rachel DeCell, community and special projects editor for the Marshall Project and Signal Cleveland. Rachel, thanks for so much for coming in, and thanks for this valuable resource.
Thank you so much.
All right, time now for a quick break, but when we return, we'll have a conversation about the legendary music club, Le Cove, in Cleveland. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back soon. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. For less than a decade, a dark, dingy club that only held about 300 people played host to some now legendary acts of the 1960s. Le Cove, an unassuming coffee house at East 105th and Euclid Avenue, got its start hosting folk musicians like Buffy St. Marie and Phil Ochs. But as the decade wore on, the nation transformed and rock music took over. The venue started showcasing musicians like Jeff Beck, The Velvet Underground, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and Neil Young. Steve Traina, a longtime radio host here in Northeast Ohio, chronicles the rise and fall of Le Cove in a new book, Le Cove, Cleveland's Legendary Music Club and the 60s Folk to Rock Revolution. He recently sat down with Sound of Ideas coordinating producer Drew Mazias.
Let's set the stage a little bit by describing the landscape in which Le Cove started. What was the area of East 105th and Euclid like in the 50s and early 60s? And then also, how did Stan Kane and Nelson Carl go about starting this place?
Good questions. Le Cove was at a place that was for generations called Doan's Corners, 105th and Euclid. And that, before where we are now, Playhouse Square, that was one of the main art theater areas in the country. Mm-hmm. So there were all kinds of theaters there, but Le Cove was not a, it was a basement. And so Nelson Carl started it with a couple other fellows. Stan didn't come on the scene for a couple, 3 months. They opened in March of 62. Nelson was this Renaissance guy. He was a downtown lawyer at his own practice. In later years, he was head counsel for the ACLU and a bunch of civil rights programs. So he was really into activism and music. Yeah. And his wife was a jazz musician. And I think, and unfortunately he passed before I could interview him, but I did have to talk to his family, and he just wanted a place to go in the evening and listen to some folk music. And so they opened in March of 62. Stan knew Nelson, but not very well. He only knew him from hanging around at Farragher's Back Room, which was a little 80-seat folk joint on South Taylor Road, next to Farragher's Bar. Hmm. Bob Gibson was playing there. Bob Gibson caught wind, and he was a smart guy. He caught wind about this 300-seat club that might close because they didn't have any action, because it wasn't a folk club yet. It was just a coffee house. And he kind of stuck a bug in Stan Kane's ear. Hey, I can get you some good acts. I'm hooked up. Because he was a famous, well-traveled, although troubled, folk singer. Yeah. And so he hooked him up with Len Rosenfeld in New York, who was Bob's agent, and they could feed him a bunch of folk music acts. Hmm. So they went through the summer with just some jazz acts and a lot of what they called hootenannies, which we call open mics now. So Stan says to, hey, I got an idea, Nelson. Why don't we just make it into a folk club? Why don't we just start booking acts? Nelson, I don't know a thing about it. Stan says, I'll handle it for you. He says, okay, you're on. And Stan papered the whole neighborhood, and he went to the colleges, and, you know, he printed a bunch of flyers. He talked to everybody he knew. The day comes. It's going to be an afternoon, Sunday afternoon gig. Bob Gibson's going to open. Mm-hmm. And Stan goes in around 9 o'clock in the morning just to clean up the place and get settled in, and there's a line already. And by the time the doors opened, the line was down to 107th and down the block.
Wow.
It was, the whole thing was oversold.
Yeah. Well, it opens, you said, in March of 1962. The country's in the middle of this big folk boom. Did it have to market itself all the time? Was it attracting big name acts right away? Or were the college students from Case Western Reserve University, were they just the built-in crowd? What did those first couple of years look like?
Well, the first couple of years were sketchy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're always robbing Peter to pay Paul, because all the receipts and checks reflect that.
Mm-hmm.
So they did not have name. I mean, they had some, regional names, but Stan's superpower was he could find people before anybody knew him and sign them affordably and put them in front of an audience. And back then, people usually played two or three sets a night,
right?
Short ones, like half hour, 40 minutes. But they'd stay for two, three, 4 days a week, even longer. And Stan could fill that, he would bring an act in, and Friday night there'd be 80 people there. Saturday night there'd be 300, because a word spread that this great band was in town. And that was very typical, that the first night of an unknown band would get sparse attendance, but the second, third, and so on, mm-hmm. people would just rolling in, and it was a couple bucks ahead, so.
Yeah. Do you attribute that to just Stan Kane's good taste? You know, he had an ear for talent.
In 1968, I believe it was, Billboard magazine came out with it said hippie acts are influencing the whole music industry, and it named nine clubs, and seven of them were either on the East Coast or West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
There were only two inland, La Cave being one of them.
Wow.
And they attributed that to his ability to come to New York, go to a bunch of clubs, see a bunch of acts, figure out the ones that he thought, we would like, mm-hmm. we the customer, and sign them.
And affordable enough that he could book them at this relatively small 300-person venue.
Exactly, exactly. And he told me one time, I asked him the same question. I said, well, he says, no, I just liked it. That was his answer all the time. I asked him many times,
how'd you know? Yeah.
I signed bands I liked.
Huh.
And what he liked turned into gold.
Yeah. Would you say La Cave ever really transitioned away from being a folk club to more of a rock-centric club? Because it seems like throughout the entire history, flipping through the book, it seems like there were still folk acts coming through, jazz groups every once in a while, really heavy on the rock later before its closure. But did it kind of do all of the above for its entire history?
No. It started out as almost purely a folk club.
Mm-hmm.
Singer-songwriters, individual acts, or a guy with an accompanist, things like that. Affordable, and no big infrastructure to pay for it.
Right.
Lights, sound, soundboard, amps, all that mm-hmm. stuff. So it was relatively easy to book single acts. But the world changed. You know, in 64, the Beatles came along, mm-hmm. and they put all the folkies out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And within a year after that, it was folk rock. It was the amalgamation of folk music that usually carried some kind of social message,
right,
and rock, which had a beat. And that's what people gravitated to after the Beatles changed the whole music.
So don't fear if you hear a foreign sound to your ear. It's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding.
In your research or anecdotally, did you find there being any kind of conflict between in those transitional years where the people that were used to going to La Cave to see folk music or were upset that more R&B and rock bands were coming in, or that the rock audiences didn't have the appetite for folk music?
Well, it's a complex question because people were aging also. Mm-hmm. So people aged out of going there. They graduated from college, let's say.
Yeah.
So although we grew older, so did the music business. Hmm. And I think the first act but it was in 1965, the latter half. So 62, 3, 4, 5 was almost primarily folk. 65 started having bands, folk mixed in, but the bands became more and more predominant, mm-hmm. because that's what people wanted.
Yeah.
That was the taste.
Let's get into some of that rock era, that electric era. You've got bands like the James Gang playing there, the Local People, and Paul Butterfield Blues Band. But I want to talk about the significance of the Velvet Underground's relationship with Le Cav, because you cite Lou Reed in the book, who is on the record talking about how important this place was
right.
in their career as a pretty monumental band.
You know, as he said, I think at the right in this building somewhere mm-hmm. in the Palace Theater, I believe, he said that Le Cav and a place in Boston kept the band alive for 3 years. Oh. He says, I really have a soft spot for Le Cav. Hmm. And he said that throughout his career.
Was that another one of those bands that Stan Kane identified early on, saw them in New York, brought them to Cleveland?
He saw them in New York, and what had happened was he had no idea who they were. He didn't like them. But in 66, at the year before they came to Le Cav, the Exploding Plastic Inevitable was at the Masonic.
Hmm.
Stan happened to go and flipped out. He loved it.
Hmm.
So he didn't really put two and two together for a while. When he did, he went after Velvet Underground.
There's a famous or an infamous story in the book of Jimi Hendrix being booked to play Le Cav for 5 nights in August of 1967, but it doesn't happen. So I'm curious, researching this book, putting this book together, did you get a sense of how difficult it must have been to book up-and-coming rock acts that were exploding at the time, becoming bigger and bigger, that could say, yeah, sorry, we're going to play this 1,000-person venue, or just kind of flaking out?
Well, sure, but this is not one of those stories.
Hmm.
So Stan was in New York in springtime of 67, Summer of Love, and Jimmy was famous in England, unknown in America. But he's based in New York. He'd been in England for a long time, a year or two, and got pretty well known. In fact, the guitar players all thought they were going to have to sell their guitars off when they heard him play. So Stan's in, he's at Steve Paul's The Scene, which is a club in New York City, sees Hendrix, talks to him, and Stan was not afraid to approach anybody at any time. He had chutzpah.
Mm-hmm.
And he signed him. Well, that was in March of 67. Nobody had ever heard of Jimi Hendrix. He started advertising, you know, put some flyers out, yada, yada. Well, June comes along, and that's the Monterey Pop Festival,
yep.
And Jimmy blows up. He's now Jimi Hendrix. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that he got higher paying gigs, because I don't think that's what motivated him. He was still playing local New York clubs. He didn't want to travel because he was putting out a new album, and he went to see Frank Zappa and the Mothers one night at the Garrick, and he was blown away by the sound, so he went backstage after and says, Frank, what am I hearing? Frank hands him his wah-wah pedal, says, this, here, try it out. So Jimmy wanted to completely re-record Axe as Bold as Love. I think that's the album mm-hmm. he was working on. And I don't have the records, but I saw the record studio or the recording studio vlog, and he's in there when he should have been at Le Cav.
Interesting.
Stan didn't know it till the last minute.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a great story. When putting this book together, were there any stories you came across, any records of people being at Le Cav where they said this was the band that just blew the roof off the place, that they played there a lot, they loved coming there, musicians in Cleveland were really turned on by these folks? Any of those acts that you can think of that you kept coming across?
There were a few. One that's amazing, the Hello People, which was a group that played folk rock in mime, in whiteface, and they didn't talk. They sang during the song, but they acted out songs in between. And for some reason, they were wildly, wildly popular at Le Cav as one of the big bands. Bob Gibson was always a big draw. And I'll inject a memory of my own.
Sure.
Because this story is not about me in any way, but the one show I remember very clearly, Tom Rush, who I really loved, folk singer, songwriter, he was coming. And so he walks out on stage when it's time to start. I think Stan introduced him, Tom Rush. And then Tom Rush walks out from behind the stage where the green room was with nothing in his hands and no, but just standing there. And he let the place quiet down for, you know, half a minute or so. And we're all kind of wondering, well, what's going on? And he yells to the back, bring out the naked lady. Now he's got everybody's attention. So somebody from the back brings out his guitar, which had an inlaid like silhouette on it. He called the guitar the naked lady. Wow. So got a big laugh and, you know, it was a great night.
Nice.
thanks for all you've done. It may sound hollow. Thank you for the good times that we've known. But I must find my own road now to follow. You will all be welcome in my home.
How do you think Cleveland's misfortunes in the late 60s played into maybe how successful or unsuccessful LaCave was? I mean, we have the city undergoing massive population decline with white flight out to the suburbs. You have things like the Hough riots happening around that time. How did all of that impact the fortunes of LaCave?
Very negatively, of course. So LaCave was, you know, kind of on the southeast corner, I guess, of the Hough neighborhood, fairly close. So in 66, you know, the riots were, they kept the place open all night, and they used it kind of as a triage place. They had some nurses there. Wow. They had some people. The police said, keep your front door locked. Don't let anybody in you don't know. Mm-hmm. And they had to cancel some shows. Fred Neil was one that got canceled. And the great thing about Stan that kind of lessened the hit was that he was always colorblind and gender blind. Mm-hmm. In an era where black folk singers weren't hired, he hired them. He had Len Chandler and Josh White Jr. And Josh White Sr. and many others, Ted Brown, and also women. Buffy St. Marie said, I couldn't get a gig in the States till Stan hired me. So that helped to lessen the blow because he had a reputation as being, you know, a good guy. Mm-hmm. Whereas some of the clubs down there were very racist. Mm-hmm. You know, you if you were the wrong color, you weren't going to certain clubs.
So the end of the road for LaCave kind of comes at a time when rock concerts are becoming a huge deal. The big productions, they couldn't compete with places like Cleveland Public Hall that were attracting Woodstock-level performers. It's interesting to read that on a weekend when Neil Young and Crazy Horse played at LaCave in 69, they drew less than 700 people for all three nights. So do you think it just wasn't a sustainable business model after a while when tastes are changing so much?
So this is hard for us to fathom today, but nobody knew who Neil Young was. He had come from a band called Buffalo Springfield.
Right.
We didn't know the names of the people in the band. So when it was Neil Young and Crazy Horse, that was just another name to most people. Hmm. And that's how Stan got people like Neil to play.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard to pay a band, a four or five piece band with all the infrastructure the club has to have to support an electric band. And, you know, I thought of a frame for the LaCave story, mm-hmm. and we Ohioans, I think, might enjoy this. A couple weeks before LaCave opened, John Glenn hopped in his tin can, flew into space for three orbits. No mm-hmm. one ever done that before. LaCave opens. LaCave closes in July of 69, and a couple weeks later, Neil Armstrong mm-hmm. walks on the moon. And I put pictures side by side of the tin can that was Friendship 7 mm-hmm. and the lunar landing module, and it's the technological advance is so, just so graphic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of it, because you had to have a sound man, you had to have a professional soundboards, you had to have mixing capabilities, and you had to have an acoustically good room.
Mm-hmm.
LaCave was in a kind of a dank basement. Everybody remarks about the sticky floor. And yeah, they couldn't afford to pay an act that was well known. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, as you're alluding to, the music business really changed around 69, 70, when Woodstock came along and the money guys in music said, oh, these kids will hitchhike across the country and sit in mud for 3 days just to listen to music. There's some money here. And it changed. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing good lasts.
The book is LaCave, Cleveland's Legendary Music Club from the 60s, Folk to Rock Revolution. Steve Traina, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Boy, listen to me now. And it was all.
That's our Drew Mazzia speaking with Steve Traina, whose book chronicling LaCave is out now. Traina will be at the B-side in Cleveland Heights. That's below the Grog Shop on Saturday, March 16th from 5 to 7 p.m. And that wraps it up for our show. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We are on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas. And you can follow me at JennyHamill_. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, it is the Friday Reporters Roundtable with Ideastream's Glenn Forbes filling in for Mike McIntyre. He's joined this week by IdeaStream reporter Anna Huntsman and deputy editor of news Stephanie Chekolinski, along with our State House News Bureau chief Karen Kassler. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I am Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening.